This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Age of Turbulence, Adventures in a New World by Alan Greenspan. Read by Robertson Dean. Introduction. On the afternoon of September 11, 2001, I was flying back to Washington on Swiss Air Flight 128, returning home from a routine international bankers' meeting in Switzerland. I'd been moving about the cabin when the chief of the security detail that escorted me on trips abroad, Bob Agnew, stopped me in the aisle. Bob is an ex-Secret Service man, friendly but not especially talkative. At that moment, he was looking grim. "Mr. Chairman," he said quietly, "the captain needs to see you up front. Two planes have flown into the World Trade Center." I must have had a quizzical look on my face, because he added, "I'm not joking." In the cockpit, the captain appeared quite nervous. He told us there had been a terrible attack against our country. Several airliners had been hijacked, and two flown into the World Trade Center and one into the Pentagon. Another plane was missing. That was all the information he had, he said in his slightly accented English. We were returning to Zurich, and he was not going to announce the reason to the other passengers. "Do we have to go back?" I asked. "Can we land in Canada?" He said no. His orders were to head to Zurich. I went back to my seat as the captain announced that air traffic control had directed us to Zurich. The phones on the seats immediately became jammed, and I couldn't get through to the ground. The Federal Reserve colleagues who had been with me in Switzerland that weekend were already on other flights. So, with no way to know how events were developing, I had nothing to do but think for the next 3.5 hours. I looked out the window. The work I'd brought along, the piles of memos and economic reports, forgotten in my bag. Were these attacks the beginning of some wider conspiracy? My immediate concern was for my wife. Andrea is NBC's chief foreign affairs correspondent in Washington. She wasn't in New York, which was one big relief, and visiting the Pentagon hadn't been on her agenda that day. I assumed she would be at the NBC bureau in the middle of town, heavily involved in covering the news, so I wasn't deeply worried, I told myself. But what if she'd gone on a last-minute visit to some general in the Pentagon? I worried about my colleagues at the Federal Reserve. Were they safe? And their families? The staff would be scrambling to respond to the crisis. This attack, the first on U.S. soil since Pearl Harbor, would throw the country into turmoil. The question I needed to focus on was whether the economy would be damaged. The possible economic crises were all too evident. The worst, which I thought highly unlikely, would be a collapse of the financial system. The Federal Reserve is in charge of the electronic payment systems that transfer more than $4 trillion a day in money and securities between banks all over the country and much of the rest of the world. We'd always thought that if you wanted to cripple the U.S. economy, you'd take out the payment systems. Banks would be forced to fall back on inefficient physical transfers of money. Businesses would resort to barter and IOUs. The level of economic activity across the country could drop like a rock. During the Cold War, as a precaution against nuclear attack, the Federal Reserve had built a large number of redundancies into the communication and computer facilities on which the money system relies. We have all sorts of safeguards so that, for example, the data of one Federal Reserve bank are backed up at another Federal Reserve bank hundreds of miles away or in some remote location. In the event of a nuclear attack, we'd be back up and running in all non-irradiated areas very quickly. This system was the one Roger Ferguson, the vice chairman of the Fed, would be calling on this day. I was confident that he and our colleagues would be taking the necessary steps to keep the world dollar system flowing. Yet even as I thought about it, I doubted that physically disrupting the financial system was what the hijackers had in mind. Much more likely, this was meant to be a symbolic act of violence against capitalist America, like the bomb in the parking garage of the World Trade Center 8 years earlier. What worried me was the fear such an attack would create, especially if there were additional attacks to come. In an economy as sophisticated as ours, people have to interact and exchange goods and services constantly, and the division of labor is so finely articulated that every household depends on commerce simply to survive. If people withdraw from everyday economic life, if investors dump their stocks, or business people back away from trades, or citizens stay home for fear of going to malls and being exposed to suicide bombers, there's a snowball effect. It's the psychology that leads to panics and recessions. A shock like the one we just sustained could cause a massive withdrawal from and major contraction in economic activity. The misery could multiply. Long before my flight touched down, I'd concluded that the world was about to change in ways that I could not yet define. The complacency we Americans had embraced for the decade following the end of the Cold War had just been shattered. We finally reached Zurich just after 8:30 p.m. local time, still early afternoon in the United States. Swiss banking officials met me as I got off the plane and rushed me to a private room in the departure lounge. They offered to show videos of the Twin Towers coming down and the fires at the Pentagon, but I declined. I'd worked in the neighborhood of the World Trade Center for much of my life and had friends and acquaintances there. I assumed the death tolls would be horrendous and would include people I knew. I didn't want to see the destruction. I just wanted a phone that worked. I finally reached Andrea on her cell phone a few minutes before 9, and it was a great relief to hear her voice. Once we'd assured each other we were okay, she told me she had to rush. She was on the set, about to go on the air with an update of the day's events. I said, "Just tell me quickly what's happening there." She was holding the cell phone to one ear while the special events producer in New York was on her earpiece in the other ear, almost shouting, "Andrea, Tom Brokaw is coming to you. Are you ready?" All she had time to say was, "Listen up." With that, she put the open cell phone on her lap and addressed the cameras. I heard exactly what America was hearing at that point, that the missing United Flight 93 had crashed in Pennsylvania. I was then able to get a call through to Roger Ferguson at the Fed. We ran through our crisis management checklist, and just as I'd figured, he had things well in hand. Then, with all civilian air travel to the United States shut down, I contacted Andy Card, the White House Chief of Staff, to request transportation back to Washington. Finally, I went back to the hotel, escorted by my security detail, to get some sleep and await instructions. By daybreak, I was airborne again, on the flight deck of a United States Air Force KC-10 tanker. It may have been the only aircraft available. The crew was used to flying refueling sorties over the North Atlantic. The mood in the cockpit was somber. "You'll never believe this," the captain said. "Listen." I put my ear to the headset, but couldn't hear anything other than static. "Normally, the North Atlantic is full of radio chatter," he explained. "This silence is eerie." Apparently, nobody else was out there. As we came down the eastern seaboard and entered prohibited U.S. airspace, we were met and escorted by a couple of F-16 fighters. The captain got permission to fly over what had been the site of the Twin Towers at the southern tip of Manhattan, now a smoking ruin. For decades, my offices had never been more than a few blocks from there. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, I had watched day by day as the Twin Towers went up. Now, from 35,000 feet, their smoky wreckage was New York's most visible landmark. I went straight to the Fed that afternoon, driven with a police escort through barricaded streets. Then we went to work. For the most part, the electronic flows of funds were doing fine. But with civilian air traffic shut down, the transportation and clearing of good old-fashioned checks were being delayed. That was a technical problem, a substantial one, but one that the staff and the individual Federal Reserve banks were entirely capable of handling by temporarily extending additional credit to commercial banks. I spent most of my time in the days that followed watching and listening for signs of a catastrophic economic slowdown. For 7 months before 9/11, the economy had been in a very minor recession, still shaking off the effects of the dot-com crash of 2000. But things had started to turn around. We had rapidly been lowering interest rates, and the markets were beginning to stabilize. By late August, public interest had shifted from the economy to Gary Condit, the California congressman whose less than forthcoming statements about a missing young woman dominated the nightly news. Andrea couldn't get on the air with anything of global significance, and I remember thinking how incredible that seemed. The world must be in pretty good shape if the TV news focused mainly on domestic scandal. Within the Fed, the biggest issue we faced was how far to lower interest rates. After 9/11, the reports and statistics streaming in from the Federal Reserve banks told a very different story. The Federal Reserve System consists of 12 banks strategically situated around the country. Each one lends money to and regulates the banks in its region. the Federal Reserve banks also serve as a window on the American economy. Officers and staff stay constantly in touch with bankers and business people in their districts, and the information they glean about orders and sales beats official published data by as much as a month. What they were telling us now was that all across the country, people had stopped spending on everything except items bought in preparation for possible additional attacks. Sales of groceries, security devices, bottled water, and insurance were up. The whole travel, entertainment, hotel, tourism, and convention business was down. We knew the shipping of fresh vegetables from the West Coast to the East Coast would be disrupted by the suspension of air freight, but we were somewhat surprised by how quickly many other businesses were hit. For example, the flow of auto parts from Windsor, Ontario to Detroit's plants slowed to a crawl at the river crossings that joined the two cities, a factor in the decision by Ford Motor to shut down temporarily five of its factories. Years earlier, many manufacturers had shifted to just-in-time production. Instead of stockpiling parts and supplies at the plant, they relied on air freight to deliver critical components as they were needed. The shutdown of the airspace and the tightening of borders led to shortages, bottlenecks, and canceled shifts. In the meantime, the U.S. government had gone into high gear. On Friday, September 14th, Congress passed an initial emergency appropriation of $40 billion and authorized the president to use force against the nations, organizations, or persons who had attacked us. President Bush rallied the nation with what will likely go down as the most effective speech of his presidency. America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world, he said, and no one will keep that light from shining. His approval ratings soared to 86%, and politics, if only for a short period, became bipartisan. Lots of ideas were being floated on Capitol Hill for helping the nation bounce back. There were plans that involved pumping funds into airlines, tourism, and recreation. There was a raft of proposals to extend tax breaks to businesses in order to encourage capital investment. Terrorism insurance was much discussed. How do you insure against such catastrophic events? And what role, if any, does the government have in that? I thought it urgent to get commercial aircraft flying again in order to abort all the negative ripple effects. Congress quickly passed a $15 billion air transport rescue bill. But beyond that, I paid less attention to most of these debates because I was intent on getting the larger picture, which still wasn't clear to me. I was convinced that the answer would not lie in big, hasty, expensive gestures. It's typical that in times of great national urgency, every congressman feels he has to put out a bill. Presidents feel the pressure to act too. Under those conditions, you can get short-sighted, ineffective, often counterproductive policies, like the gasoline rationing that President Nixon imposed during the first OPEC oil shock in 1973. That policy caused gas lines in some parts of the country that fall. But with 14 years under my belt as Fed chairman, I'd seen the economy pull through a lot of crises, including the largest one-day crash in the history of the stock market, which happened 5 weeks after I took the job. We'd survived the real estate boom and bust of the 1980s, the savings and loan crisis, and the Asian financial upheavals, not to mention the recession of 1990. We'd enjoyed the longest stock market boom in history and then weathered the ensuing dot-com crash. I was gradually coming to believe that the U.S. economy's greatest strength was its resiliency, its ability to absorb disruptions and recover, often in ways and at a pace you'd never be able to predict, much less dictate. Yet in this terrible circumstance, there was no way to know what would happen. I thought the best strategy was to observe and wait until we understood better what the precise fallout from 9/11 would be. That is what I told the congressional leadership in a meeting in the House Speaker's office on the afternoon of September 19th. Speaker Dennis Hastert, House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, and Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle, along with Bob Rubin, the former Secretary of the Treasury under President Clinton, and White House Economic Advisor Larry Lindsey, all met in a plain conference room attached to Hastert's office on the House side of the Capitol. The legislators wanted to hear assessments of the economic impact of the attacks from Lindsey, Rubin, and me. There was great seriousness to the ensuing discussion, no grandstanding. I remember thinking, this is the way government should work. Lindsey put forward the idea that as the terrorists had dealt a blow to American confidence, the best way to counter it would be a tax cut. He and others argued for pumping about $100 billion into the economy as soon as possible. The number didn't alarm me. It was about 1% of the country's total annual output. But I told them we had no way of knowing yet whether $100 billion was too much or too little. Yes, the airlines and the tourism industries had been severely impacted, and the newspapers were full of stories about all sorts of layoffs. Yet on Monday, September 17th, amazingly, the New York Stock Exchange had succeeded in reopening just 3 blocks from Ground Zero. It was an important step because it brought a sense of normalcy back to the system, a bright spot in the picture we were still piecing together at the Fed. At the same time, the check payment system was recovering, and the stock market hadn't crashed. Prices had merely gone down and then stabilized, an indication that most companies were not in serious trouble. I told them the prudent course was to continue to work on options and meet back in 2 weeks, when we'd know more. I delivered the same message the next morning to a public hearing of the Senate Banking Committee, counseling patients. Nobody has the capacity to fathom fully how the tragedy of September 11th will play out. But in the weeks ahead, as the shock wears off, we should be able to better gauge how the ongoing dynamics of these events are shaping the immediate economic outlook. I also emphasized, over the past couple of decades, the American economy has become increasingly resilient to shocks. Deregulated financial markets, far more flexible labor markets, and more recently, the major advances in information technology have enhanced our ability to absorb disruptions and recover. In fact, I was putting a better face on the situation than I feared might be the case. Like most people in government, I fully expected more attacks. That feeling went mainly unspoken in public, but you could see it in the unanimity of the Senate votes. 98-0 for authorizing the use of force against terrorists, 100-0 for the aviation security bill. I was particularly concerned about a weapon of mass destruction, possibly a nuclear device stolen from the Soviet arsenal during the chaos of the collapse of the USSR. I also contemplated the contamination of our reservoirs. Yet, on the record, I took a less pessimistic stance, because if I had fully expressed what I thought the probabilities were, I'd have scared the markets half to death. I realized I probably wasn't fooling anybody, though. People in the markets would hear me and say, "I sure hope he's right." In late September, the first hard data came in. Typically, the earliest clear indicator of what's happening to the economy is the number of new claims for unemployment benefits, a statistic compiled each week by the Department of Labor. For the third week of the month, claims topped 450,000, about 13% above their level in late August. The figure confirmed the extent and seriousness of the hardships we'd been seeing in news reports about people who'd lost their jobs. I could imagine those thousands of hotel and resort workers, and others now in limbo, not knowing how they would support themselves and their families. I was coming to the view that the economy was not going to bounce back quickly. The shock was severe enough that even a highly flexible economy would have difficulty dealing with it. Like many other analysts, economists at the Fed were looking at all the proposed packages of spending and tax cuts and the numbers associated with them. In each case, we tried to cut through the details to gauge the order of magnitude. Interestingly, they all fell in the ballpark of $100 billion. Larry Lindsay's initial suggestion. We reconvened in Hastert's conference room on Wednesday, October 3rd, to talk again about the economy. Another week had passed, and the number of initial jobless claims had gotten worse. An additional 517,000 people had applied for unemployment benefits. By now, my mind was made up. While I still expected more attacks, there was no way to know how devastating they might be or how to protect the economy in advance. I told the group that we should take steps to offset the damage we could measure, and that it was indeed time for a constrained stimulus. What seemed about right was a package of actions on the order of $100 billion. Enough, but not so much that it would overstimulate the economy and cause interest rates to rise. The lawmakers seemed to agree. I went home that night, thinking that all I'd done was articulate and reinforce a consensus. The $100 billion figure had first come from Larry. So I was surprised to read the media's spin on the meeting, which made it sound almost as though I were running the entire show. Time magazine, for example, opined on October 15, 2001, Greenspan's shift provided the green light lawmakers had been waiting for. The White House and leaders of both parties have agreed with Greenspan's assessment that new spending and tax cuts should total about 1% of the country's annual income, that it should make its effects felt quickly, and that it should not threaten to balloon the deficit so much down the road that it immediately raises long-term interest rates. While it was gratifying to hear that Congress and the administration were listening to me, I found these press reports unsettling. I've never been entirely comfortable being cast as the person who calls the shots. From my earliest days, I had viewed myself as an expert behind the scenes, an implementer of orders rather than the leader. It took the stock market crisis of 1987 to make me feel comfortable making critical policy decisions. But to this day, I feel ill at ease in the spotlight. Extrovert, I am not. Of course, the irony was that in spite of my supposed persuasive power, in the weeks after 9/11, nothing worked out as I expected. Anticipating a second terrorist attack was probably one of the worst predictions I ever made. And the constrained stimulus I had supposedly greenlighted didn't happen either. It bogged down in politics and stalled. The package that finally emerged in March 2002 not only was months too late, but also had little to do with the general welfare. It was an embarrassing mess of pork barrel projects. Yet the economy righted itself. Industrial production, after just one more month of mild decline, bottomed out in November. By December, the economy was growing again, and jobless claims dropped back and stabilized at their pre-9/11 level. The Fed did have a hand in that, but it was only by stepping up what we'd been doing before 9/11, cutting interest rates to make it easier for people to borrow and spend. I didn't mind seeing my expectations upset, because the economy's remarkable response to the aftermath of 9/11 was proof of an enormously important fact. Our economy had become highly resilient. What I'd said so optimistically to the Senate Banking Committee turned out to be true. After those first awful weeks, America's households and businesses recovered. What had generated such an unprecedented degree of economic flexibility, I asked myself. Economists have been trying to answer questions like that since the days of Adam Smith. We think we have our hands full today trying to comprehend our globalized economy. But Smith had to invent economics, almost from scratch, as a way to reckon with the development of complex market economies in the 18th century. I'm hardly Adam Smith, but I've got the same inquisitiveness about understanding the broad forces that define our age. This book is in part a detective story. After 9/11, I knew, if I needed further reinforcement, that we are living in a new world. The world of a global capitalist economy that is vastly more flexible, resilient, open, self-correcting, and fast-changing than it was even a quarter century earlier. It's a world that presents us with enormous new possibilities, but also enormous new challenges. The Age of Turbulence is my attempt to understand the nature of this new world, how we got here, what we're living through, and what lies over the horizon, for good and for ill. Where possible, I convey my understanding in the context of my own experiences. I do this out of a sense of responsibility to the historical record and so that readers will know where I'm coming from. The book is therefore divided into halves. The first half is my effort to retrace the arc of my learning curve, and the second half is a more objective effort to use this as the foundation on which to erect a conceptual framework for understanding the new global economy. Along the way, I explore critical elements of this emerging global environment, the principles of governing it that arose out of the Enlightenment of the 18th century, the vast energy infrastructure that powers it, the global financial imbalances and dramatic shifts in world demographics that threaten it, and, despite its unquestioned success, the chronic concern over the justice of the distribution of its rewards. Finally, I bring together what we can reasonably conjecture about the makeup of the world economy in 2030. I don't pretend to know all the answers, but from my vantage point at the Federal Reserve, I had privileged access to the best that had been thought and said on a wide range of subjects. I had access to the broad scope of academic literature that addressed many of the problems my Fed colleagues and I had to grapple with every day. Without the Fed staff, I could never have coped with the sheer volume of academic output, some exceptionally trenchant and some tedious. I had the privilege of calling one or more of the Federal Reserve Board's economic staff and asking about academic work of current or historical interest. I would shortly receive detailed evaluations of the pros and cons on virtually any subject, from the latest mathematical models developed to assess risk neutrality to the emergence and impact of land-grant colleges in the American Midwest. So, I have not been inhibited in reaching for some fairly sweeping hypotheses. A number of global forces have gradually, sometimes almost clandestinely, altered the world as we know it. The most visible to most of us has been the increasing transformation of everyday life by cell phones, personal computers, email, BlackBerries, and the Internet. The exploration after World War II of the electronic characteristics of silicon led to the development of the microprocessor, and when fiber optics combined with lasers and satellites revolutionized communications capacities, people from Pekin, Illinois to Peking, China saw their lives change. A large percentage of the world's population gained access to technologies that I, in setting out on my long career in 1948, could not have imagined, except in the context of science fiction. These new technologies not only opened up a whole new vista of low-cost communications, but also facilitated major advances in finance that greatly enhanced our ability to direct scarce savings into productive capital investments, a critical enabler of rapidly expanding globalization and prosperity. Tariff barriers declined in the years following World War II, a result of a general recognition that protectionism before the war had led to a spiraling down of trade. A reversal of the international division of labor, which contributed to the virtual collapse of world economic activity. The post-war liberalization of trade helped open up new low-cost sources of supply, coupled with the development of new financial institutions and products, made possible in part by silicon-based technologies. It facilitated the forward thrust toward global market capitalism even during the years of the Cold War. In the following quarter century, the embrace of free market capitalism helped bring inflation to quiescence and interest rates to single digits globally. The defining moment for the world's economies was the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, revealing a state of economic ruin behind the Iron Curtain far beyond the expectations of the most knowledgeable Western economists. Central planning was exposed as an unredeemable failure, coupled with and supported by the growing disillusionment over the interventionist economic policies of the Western democracies, market capitalism began quietly to displace those policies in much of the world. Central planning was no longer a subject for debate. There were no eulogies. Except in North Korea and Cuba, it was dropped from the world's economic agenda. Not only did the economies of the former Soviet bloc, after some chaos, embrace the ways of market capitalism, but so did most of what we previously called the Third World, countries that had been neutral in the Cold War but had practiced central planning or had been so heavily regulated that it amounted to the same thing. Communist China, which had edged toward market capitalism as early as 1978, accelerated the movement of its vast, tightly regulated, then more than 500 million person workforce toward the free trade zones of the Pearl River Delta. China's shift in protecting the property rights of foreigners, while subtle, was substantial enough to induce a veritable explosion in foreign direct investment, FDI, into China following 1991. From a level of $57 million in 1980, FDI drifted upward, reaching $4 billion in 1991, and then accelerated at a 21% annual rate, reaching $70 billion in 2006. The investment, joined with the abundance of low-cost labor, resulted in a potent combination that exerted downward pressure on wages and prices throughout the developed world. Earlier, the much smaller so-called Asian tigers, especially South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan, had showed the way by engaging developed country technologies to bring their standard of living sharply higher through exports to the West. The rate of economic growth of these and many other developing nations far outstripped the rate of growth elsewhere. The result has been the shift of a significant share of the world's gross domestic product, GDP, to the developing world, a trend with dramatic ripple effects. Developing countries typically have much higher savings rates than do industrialized nations, in part because developing nations' social safety nets are weaker, so households naturally set aside more money for times of need and retirement. Other factors also play a part. In the absence of well-established consumer cultures, for example, households have less inclination to spend. The shift of shares of world GDP since 2001 from low-saving developed countries to higher-saving developing countries has increased world savings so much that the aggregate growth of savings worldwide has greatly exceeded planned investments. The market process that equalizes actual global saving and investment, we have to assume, has driven real interest rates, nominal interest rates adjusted for inflation expectations, markedly lower. Or, to put it another way, the supply of funds looking for a return on investment has grown faster than investor demand. The apparent excess in savings, combined with globalization, technology-driven increases in productivity, and the shift of workforces from centrally planned economies to competitive markets, has helped suppress interest rates, both real and nominal, and rates of inflation for all developed and virtually all developing nations. It is why annual inflation rates almost everywhere, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, and Iran being notable exceptions, are currently in single digits, one of the few times, perhaps the only time, this has happened since the abandonment of the gold standard and the embrace of fiat, or paper, currencies in the 1930s. What is particularly striking about this set of forces is that, largely serendipitously, they all came together at the beginning of the 21st century. Central banks' monetary policy was not the primary cause of the persistent decline in inflation and long-term interest rates, but we central bankers chose to alter our policies to maximize the long-term benefits of these tectonic shifts in global finance. Yet, for reasons I will outline later, none of these forces is likely to be permanent. Inflation in a fiat money world is difficult to suppress. The decline of real inflation-adjusted long-term interest rates that has occurred in the past two decades has been associated with rising price-to-earnings ratios for stocks, real estate, and in fact all income-earning assets. The market value of assets worldwide between 1985 and 2006, as a consequence, rose at a pace faster than that of nominal world GDP. The 2001-2002 period was the notable exception. This created a major increase in world liquidity. Stock and bond prices, homes, commercial real estate, paintings, and most everything else joined in the boom. Homeowners in many developed nations were able to dip into their growing home equity to finance purchases beyond what their incomes could finance. Increased household spending, especially in the United States, absorbed much of the surge of exports from the rapidly expanding developing world. As The Economist put it at year-end 2006, having grown at an annual rate of 3.2% per head since 2000, the world economy is over halfway towards notching up its best decade ever. If it keeps going at this clip, it will beat both the supposedly idyllic 1950s and the 1960s. Market capitalism, the engine that runs most of the world economy, seems to be doing its job well. Such developments have been on the whole both sweeping and positive. The reinstatement of open markets and free trade during the past quarter century has elevated many hundreds of millions of the world population from poverty. Admittedly, many others around the globe are still in need, but large segments of the developing world's population have come to experience a measure of affluence, long the monopoly of so-called developed countries. If the story of the past quarter of a century has a one-line plot summary, it is the rediscovery of the power of market capitalism. After being forced into retreat by its failures of the 1930s and the subsequent expansion of state intervention through the 1960s, market capitalism slowly reemerged as a potent force, beginning in earnest in the 1970s, until it now pervades almost all of the world to a greater or lesser extent. The spreading of a commercial rule of law, and especially the protection of the rights to property, has fostered a worldwide entrepreneurial stirring. This, in turn, has led to the creation of institutions that now anonymously guide an ever-increasing share of human activity, an international version of Adam Smith's invisible hand. As a consequence, the control of governments over the daily lives of their citizens has lessened. The forces of the marketplace have gradually displaced some significant powers of the state. Much regulation promulgating limits to commercial life has been dismantled. Throughout the early post-World War II years, international capital flows were controlled and exchange rates were in the grip of finance ministers' discretion. Central planning was widespread in both the developing and the developed world, including remnants of the earlier dirigiste planning still prominent in Europe. It was taken as gospel that markets needed government guidance to function effectively. At the meetings in the mid-1970s of the Economic Policy Committee of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, made up of policymakers from 24 countries, only Hans Tietmeyer of West Germany and I were pressing for market-based policymaking. We were a very small minority on a very large committee. The views of John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist, had replaced those of Adam Smith and his classical economics when the Great Depression of the 1930s failed to follow Smith's model of the way economies were supposed to behave. Keynes offered a mathematically elegant solution to why the world economy had stagnated and how government deficit spending could bring prompt recovery. Keynesian interventionism was still the overwhelmingly dominant paradigm in the mid-1970s, though it was already on the cusp of decline. The consensus within the Economic Policy Committee was that letting the market set wages and prices was inadequate and unreliable and needed to be supplemented by incomes policies. These differed from country to country, but generally set guidelines for wage negotiations between unions, which were very much more widespread and powerful than today, and management. Incomes policies fell short of all-out wage and price controls in that they were ostensibly voluntary. The guidelines, however, were generally backed up by the regulatory levers of government, which were employed to persuade transgressors. When such policies failed, formal wage and price controls were often the response. President Nixon's ill-fated, though initially immensely popular, wage and price controls of 1971 were among the last vestiges of post-war general wage and price interventionism in the developed world. In my early schooling, I had learned to appreciate the theoretical elegance of competitive markets. In the 6 decades since, I have learned to appreciate how theories work, and sometimes don't, in the real world. I have been particularly privileged to have interacted with all the key economic policymakers of the past generation, and to have had unparalleled access to information measuring world trends, both numerical and anecdotal. It was inevitable that I would generalize on my experiences. Doing so has led me to an even deeper appreciation of competitive free markets as a force for good. Indeed, short of a few ambiguous incidents, I can think of no circumstances where the expanded rule of law and enhanced property rights failed to increase material prosperity. Nonetheless, there is persistent, widespread questioning of the justice of how unfettered competition distributes its rewards. Throughout this book, I point to the continued ambivalence of people to market forces. Competition is stressful because competitive markets create winners and losers. This book will try to examine the ramifications of the collision between a rapidly changing globalized economy and unwavering human nature. The economic success of the past quarter millennium is the outcome of this struggle. So is the anxiety that such rapid change has wrought. We rarely look closely at the principal operating unit of economic activity, the human being. What are we? What is fixed in our nature and not subject to change, and how much discretion and free will do we have to act and learn? I have been struggling with this question since I first knew to ask it. As I've traveled across the globe for nearly 6 decades, I have found that people exhibit remarkable similarities that by no stretch of the imagination can be construed as resulting from culture, history, language, or chance. All people appear motivated by an inbred striving for self-esteem that is in large part fostered by the approval of others. That striving determines much of what households spend their money on. It will also continue to induce people to work in plants and offices side by side, even though they will soon have the technical capability of contributing in isolation through cyberspace. People have an inbred need to interact with other people. It is essential if we are to receive their approval, which we all seek. The true hermit is a rare aberration. What contributes to self-esteem depends on the broad range of learned or consciously chosen values that people believe, correctly or mistakenly, enhance their lives. We cannot function without some set of values to guide the multitude of choices we make every day. The need for values is inbred. Their content is not. That need is driven by an innate moral sense in all of us, the basis upon which a majority have sought the guidance of the numerous religions that humans have embraced over the millennia. Part of that innate moral code is a sense of what is just and proper. We all have different views of what is just, but none can avoid the built-in necessity of making such judgments. This built-in necessity is the basis of the laws that govern every society. It is the basis on which we hold people responsible for their actions. Economists cannot avoid being students of human nature, particularly of exuberance and fear. Exuberance is a celebration of life. We have to perceive life as enjoyable to seek to sustain it. Regrettably, a surge of exuberance sometimes also causes people to reach beyond the possible. When reality strikes home, exuberance turns to fear. Fear is an automatic response in all of us to threats to our deepest of all inbred propensities, our will to live. It is also the basis of many of our economic responses, the risk aversion that limits our willingness to invest and to trade, especially far from home, and that, in the extreme, induces us to disengage from markets, precipitating a severe fall-off of economic activity. A major aspect of human nature, the level of human intelligence, has a great deal to do with how successful we are in gaining the sustenance needed for survival. As I point out at the end of this book, in economies with cutting-edge technologies, people, on average, seem unable to increase their output per hour at better than 3% a year over a protracted period. That is apparently the maximum rate at which human innovation can move standards of living forward. We are apparently not smart enough to do better. The new world in which we now live is giving many citizens much to fear, including the uprooting of many previously stable sources of identity and security. Where change is most rapid, widening disparities in the distribution of income are a key concern. It is indeed an age of turbulence, and it would be imprudent and immoral to minimize the human cost of its disruptions. In the face of the increasing integration of the global economy, the world's citizens face a profound choice: to embrace the worldwide benefits of open markets and open societies that pull people out of poverty and up the ladder of skills to better, more meaningful lives, while bearing in mind fundamental issues of justice, or to reject that opportunity and embrace nativism, tribalism, populism, indeed all of the isms into which communities retreat when their identities are under siege and they cannot perceive better options. There are enormous obstacles facing us in the decades ahead, and whether we surmount them is up to us. For Americans, opening our borders to the world's skilled workforce and education reform must be high on the policy agenda. But so, too, must be finding a solution to our looming Medicare crisis. These are subjects to which I will return at the book's end. I conclude in the last chapter that despite the many shortcomings of human beings, it is no accident that we persevere and advance in the face of adversity. It is in our nature, a fact that has, over the decades, buoyed my optimism about our future. Chapter 1. City Kid. If you go to the west side of Manhattan and take the subway north, past Times Square, Central Park, and Harlem, you come to the neighborhood where I grew up. Washington Heights is almost at the opposite end of the island from Wall Street, and not far from the meadow where Peter Minuit is said to have bought Manhattan from the Indians for $24. There's a commemorative rock there today. The neighborhood was mostly low-rise brick apartment buildings filled with families of Jewish immigrants who had streamed in before the First World War, as well as some of Irish and German origin. Both sides of my family, the Greenspans and the Goldsmiths, arrived at the turn of the century, the Greenspans from Romania and the Goldsmiths from Hungary. Most families in the neighborhood, including ours, were lower middle class, unlike the utterly poverty-stricken Jews of the Lower East Side. Even during the worst years of the Depression, when I was in grade school, we had enough to eat. If any of our relatives experienced hardship, I never knew it. I even got an allowance, 25 cents a week. I was an only child, born in 1926, and my parents were soon divorced. They split up before I can remember. My father, Herbert, moved back to Brooklyn, where he'd grown up. He lived with his parents until eventually he remarried. I remained with my mother, Rose, who raised me. Though she was only 26 and was very attractive, she took back her maiden name and never married again. She found a job as a sales lady at the Ludwig Bauman furniture store in the Bronx and was able to hold it through the Depression. She was the one who made ends meet. She was the youngest of five brothers and sisters, so we were part of a larger family. My cousins and uncles and aunts were always in and out of our lives, which made up somewhat for not having a father around, or siblings. For a time, my mother and I lived with my grandparents, Nathan and Anna. The Goldsmiths were a lively, musical bunch. My Uncle Murray was a pianist who could sight-read the most famously complex masterpieces. Changing his name to Mario Silva, he went into show business and co-wrote a Broadway musical, Song of Love, about the composer Robert Schumann. Eventually, he headed to Hollywood, where Song of Love was made into a movie starring Katharine Hepburn and Paul Hohnreid. At family gatherings every few months, my uncle would play and my mother would sing. She had a soulful contralto voice and liked to imitate Helen Morgan, a torch singer and Broadway actress famous for popularizing songs like Can't Help Lovin' That Man. Otherwise, my mother lived a quiet, family-centered life. She was optimistic and even-tempered, and not intellectual in the least. Her reading consisted of the Daily News, a tabloid. Instead of bookshelves, our living room featured a piano, a baby grand. My cousin Wesley, who was 4 years older than I, was the nearest I had to a brother. During the summer months of the early 1930s, his family would rent a house not far from the ocean in a neighborhood called Edgemere, way down in the southern reaches of Queens. Wesley and I would scour the beaches looking for coins. We were very successful at it. Even though it was the depths of the Great Depression, people could still be relied upon to take coins to the beach and lose them in the sand. The only obvious legacy of our hobby is my habit of walking with my head down. If anyone asks, I tell them, I'm looking for money. But not having a dad left a big hole in my life. Every month or so, I'd take the subway and go visit him in Brooklyn. He worked on Wall Street as a broker, or in those days what they called a customer's man, for small firms you've never heard of. He was a slim, handsome guy who looked a little like Gene Kelly, and he presented himself well. Yet he never made very much money. He always seemed to feel awkward talking to me, and it made me feel awkward too. He was smart, though, and in 1935, when I was nine, he wrote a book called Recovery Ahead, which he dedicated to me. It predicted that FDR's New Deal was going to bring back good times to the U.S. economy. He made a big deal of presenting a copy to me, with this inscription. To my son Alan, may this, my initial effort, with constant thought of you, branch out into an endless chain of similar efforts, so that at your maturity you may look back and endeavor to interpret the reasoning behind these logical forecasts and begin a like work of your own. Your dad. During my years as Fed chairman, I would show this to people from time to time. They all concluded that the ability to give inscrutable testimony before Congress must have been inherited. As a 9-year-old, however, I was totally mystified. I looked at the book, read a few pages, and put it aside. My affinity for numbers probably did come from him. When I was very young, my mother used to trot me out in front of relatives and ask, Alan, what's 35 plus 92? I'd announce the answer after adding in my head. Then she'd use bigger numbers, then switch to multiplication, and so on. Despite this early claim to fame, I was not a confident boy. While my mother could make herself the star of the family party, I was more inclined to sit in the corner. At the age of 9, I became an avid baseball fan. The polo grounds were just a short walk away, and kids from the neighborhood could often get in free to watch the Giants play. My favorite team was the Yankees, however, and getting to Yankee Stadium involved a subway trip, so mainly I read about them in the newspapers. Although regular game broadcasts did not arrive in New York until 1939, the 1936 World Series was broadcast, and I developed my own technique of keeping box scores. I always used green paper and recorded each game pitch by pitch using an elaborate code I made up. My mind, which had been essentially empty to that point, filled with baseball statistics. To this day, I can recite the lineup of Yankees starting players, complete with their positions and batting averages, for that World Series. It was Joe DiMaggio's rookie season. He hit .323, and the Yanks beat the Giants 4-2. I learned fractions doing batting averages. 3-for-11 was .273, 5-for-13 was .385, 7-for-22 was .318. I was never as good converting fractions above 4-for-10, since few batters hit over .400. I wanted to be a ball player myself. I played on neighborhood teams, and I was pretty good. I'm a lefty, and I had the agility and reflexes to make a solid first baseman. By the time I was 14, one of the bigger guys, who was maybe 18, told me, "You keep going at the rate you're going, you could be in the major leagues someday." Needless to say, I was thrilled. But that is the very moment at which my progress stopped. I never fielded or hit as well after that season. I'd peaked at 14. Besides baseball, I got into Morse code. In the late 1930s, cowboy movies were in vogue. We'd pay 25 cents to go to the local theater to see the latest adventure of Hopalong Cassidy. But the characters who really intrigued me were the telegraph operators. Not only did they have the power of instantaneous communication at their fingertips, at crucial moments in the plot, they could call for help or warn of an impending Indian attack, as long as the lines hadn't been cut, but also there was artistry involved. A skilled telegraph operator could communicate 40 or 50 words per minute, and an equally skilled person at the other end not only would get the message, but could tell just from the distinctive rhythm and sound of the code who was transmitting. "That's Joe's fist," he would say. My buddy Herbie Holmes and I rigged up a battery and two key sets and practiced sending messages. We never got above tortoise speed, but just knowing the code gave me the thrill of that world. Much later in life, I was able to experience that same sense of awe at communicating across continents via satellite with my fellow central bankers. Secretly, I yearned for a way out of New York. At night, sometimes, I'd huddle at the radio, turning the dial, trying to pick up stations far away. From about age 11, I built a collection of railroad timetables from all over the country. I'd spent hours memorizing the routes and the names of towns in the 48 states. Methodically, I'd imagine taking a trip on, say, the Great Northern, crossing the vast plains of Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana, stopping at places like Fargo and Minot and Havre, then heading onward across the Continental Divide. When I was 13, my father unexpectedly invited me on a business trip to Chicago. We went to Penn Station and boarded the Broadway Limited, the Pennsylvania Railroad's flagship train, which headed down to Philadelphia before turning west. Then it carried us through Harrisburg and Altoona, and by the time we reached Pittsburgh, it was night. In the dark, we passed by huge steel-making furnaces, spewing flame and sparks, my first exposure to the industry that would become my specialty in later years. In Chicago, I took pictures of landmarks like the Water Tower and Lakeshore Drive, and after we got home, I developed them in my darkroom. Photography was another of my hobbies. That trip helped solidify my dream of finding a more interesting life than being an average kid in Washington Heights. But I never discussed this with another soul. Though my mother knew I collected timetables, I'm certain she didn't realize what they meant to me. It was her world that I was escaping. My other great passion was music. I took up the clarinet at age 12 after hearing my cousin Claire play and practiced with total dedication between 3 and 6 hours a day. Initially, I focused on classical music, but quickly I expanded to jazz. A friend who had a phonograph invited me over and put on a record of Benny Goodman and his orchestra playing Sing, 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 and instantly I was hooked. It was a thrilling time in music. Goodman and Artie Shaw and Fletcher Henderson had sparked a new era by combining 1920s dance music with elements of ragtime, black spirituals, blues, and European music to create the so-called big band sound. It was so popular and influential that in 1938, Goodman and his orchestra were invited to play the first non-classical concert at Carnegie Hall. I took up tenor sax in addition to clarinet. To my ear, sax was the most satisfying, jazziest element of the big band sound. One of my heroes was Glenn Miller, who gave the music a new velvet dimension by grouping a clarinet with two alto and two tenor saxes in his band. In 1941, when I was 15, I took the subway to the Hotel Pennsylvania to hear his band play. I was able to maneuver myself right up next to the bandstand, just 10 feet from Glenn Miller himself. The band started to play a dance arrangement of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. I piped up, "That's the Pathétique," and Miller looked over at me and said, "That's terrific, kid." George Washington High School, about a mile and a half from our apartment, was one of the city's largest and best public schools. When I started in the fall of 1940, it had room for 3,000 students, including the night school, but many more of us attended. If you were from outside the neighborhood, you had to compete for admission, and the classes were fiercely competitive. Partly this was because of the Depression. Many of us felt we weren't starting with any advantages, so it was imperative that we work hard. The same competition expressed itself on the playing field. GW was a force among the city's schools in both baseball and football. There was also the added uncertainty of war. Although Pearl Harbor was still more than a year away, Nazi Germany had just conquered Western Europe. The radio was full of news of freighters on the Atlantic being sunk by U-boats, and crackly transmissions of Edward R. Murrow reported on London under siege by the Luftwaffe. We were particularly conscious of the war because our classes had swelled with refugees, mainly Jews whose families had fled the Nazis a few years before. Henry Kissinger was a senior when I enrolled, though we were not to meet for 3 decades. I remember sitting in math class with John Kameny, a Hungarian refugee who would one day become Albert Einstein's mathematical assistant and who would co-invent the basic computer language with Thomas Kurtz, and still later become president of Dartmouth College. John hadn't been in America long and spoke with a heavy accent, but he was brilliant at math. I wondered if this might be at least in part a result of superior schooling he'd received in Hungary. So I asked, "Is that because you're from Europe?" I hoped he'd say yes, because that would mean his advantage wasn't innate and I could possibly catch him by studying hard. But the question just seemed to bemuse him. He shrugged and said, "Everybody is." I worked hard at George Washington, but did not get uniformly great grades. When I concentrated, I was a good student, and I did really well in math. But I did just okay in courses that didn't interest me, because baseball and music took up so much of my time. Music was becoming ever more central to my life. Playing was a source of cash. I joined dance bands and could make $10 a weekend by playing a couple of jobs. I remember exactly where I was on the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, in my room practicing my clarinet. I'd turned on the radio to take a break, and there was the announcement. I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Nobody did. I didn't immediately think, "Oh, we're going to war." Instead, I hoped this calamity would just go away. When you're a 15-year-old boy, you blank out a lot of things. You just focus on what you're doing. Of course, the war was impossible to ignore. Rationing started that spring, and most of the kids were going straight into the service as soon as they graduated and turned 18. In the summer of 1942, I joined a 6-piece band that went up to play the season at a resort hotel in the Catskills. There weren't many young people staying there. We were mostly playing for people our parents' age, and the mood was subdued. All spring, we'd been rapidly losing the war in the Pacific, and even after the decisive U.S. victory in the Battle of Midway, the censorship was such that you couldn't really tell what was going on, but it rarely seemed good. I graduated from GW in June 1943 and had no interest in college. I would turn 18 in March 1944 and wanted to use the time before I was drafted for more musical training. So I kept playing in small bands and signed up for classes at Juilliard, the city's great private conservatory of music, where I studied clarinet, piano, and composition. If I had any plan for the future at all, it was the thought that maybe I could join an army band. The draft board called me in that following spring. I took the long subway ride downtown for my physical, which was at a big induction center they'd set up at the old Custom House on Battery Park, a huge building with sculptures and murals and high, echoing spaces where hundreds of men my age waited in lines. Everything went along routinely until I had my fluoroscopy. That's when they check your lungs for tuberculosis. A sergeant called me out of the line and over to his desk. "We found a spot on your lung," he said. "We can't tell if it's active." With that, he handed me some papers and the address of a tuberculosis specialist. I was to go see him and report back. When I saw the specialist the next day, he was unable to make a definitive diagnosis. He said, "We're going to have to watch this for a year." I was classified unfit to serve. I was distraught. Everybody was in the army. I was the odd man out, excluded. There was also the deeper fear that I had something serious. I had no symptoms, no difficulty breathing or anything like that, and as a clarinetist and sax player I'd have noticed. But the shadow on the X-ray couldn't be denied. I remember sitting with a girlfriend later that week on a slope of grass looking out toward the George Washington Bridge and saying, If I have tuberculosis, I guess my life is over. It was my tenor sax teacher, Bill Shiner, who gave me a way out of this limbo. Bill was one of the legendary mentors of jazz musicians. His method was to organize small ensembles of four or five saxophones and a clarinet and have the students compose some of the music themselves. In our little ensemble, Shiner had me sit next to a 15-year-old by the name of Stanley Getz. Jazz historians today rank Getz in a league with Miles Davis and John Coltrane. Shiner's asking me to keep up with him was a little like asking a cocktail lounge piano player to trade arpeggios with Mozart. Getz and I got along fine, but when he played, I'd just listen in awe. Sometimes, when confronted with a supremely talented individual, you can see the road to that level of ability and hope that you might follow that road yourself. With other people, the talent has a more genetic source, and no amount of practice can help you match it. Stan Getz was in that second category. I knew intuitively that I could never learn to do what he did. Nonetheless, I did become a much better sax player from those sessions, which testifies to Shiner's shrewdness as a teacher. When I told him I'd been rejected for military service, he just laughed. He said, "That means there's nothing to stop you from getting a job." And he told me there was a slot open in Henry Jerome's outfit. The Henry Jerome Orchestra was a 14-man ensemble that had become fairly prominent on the East Coast. When I auditioned and got invited to join, it marked a big change in my life. It was not quite like making the major leagues, more like AAA ball, but it was still a full-fledged professional job in which I paid union dues and made a pretty good income for those days. And since the band spent about half of its time in the city and half touring the eastern United States, it also got me away from New York City on my own for the first time. It was by far the best band I'd ever played with. Henry Jerome was part of the avant-garde. His band later brought the bop sound of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie to conventional big band fare by adding a lot of percussion and flash. And though the band never achieved lasting fame, a surprising number of my fellow musicians and our successors went on to memorable careers. Johnny Mandel, one of our trombonists, went to Hollywood and wrote The Shadow of Your Smile and the theme music for MASH and won an Academy Award and four Grammys. A drummer, Stan Levy, later played with Charlie Parker. Larry Rivers became a major pop artist. And my fellow sax player, Lenny Garment, became President Nixon's lawyer. Our music was the style that crowds liked as the tide of the war turned in 1944. For the next 16 months, we played famous venues like the Blue Room at the Hotel Lincoln in New York and Child's Paramount Restaurant on Times Square. We played dances at Virginia Beach outside Newport News, where the audience was mostly shipbuilders and Navy families. We played theaters where sometimes we'd share the bill with vaudeville acts, kid dance teams that were warming up for a shot at Hollywood, and singers who'd been prominent in Al Jolson's prime and were still around. We spent the month of December 1944 headlining at the Roosevelt Hotel in New Orleans, which was the farthest I'd ever been from home. One night I was walking on a street near the river and looked up to see an oil tanker pass by. It always stayed with me how far below sea level New Orleans is. When the levees broke after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, that early experience helped me understand immediately the extent of the disaster. During my time with the band, we followed a routine dictated by union rules. 40 minutes on the bandstand and 20 minutes off. I loved the 40 minutes on. The experience of playing in a good band is utterly different from what you hear simply standing in front. Voices and overtones come to you from all directions. You feel the rhythm section in your bones, and all the people in the band dynamically interact. Soloists are able to build on that foundation to express their view of the world. I idolized the great improvisers like Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw, but I rarely sought a soloist role. I was content being a sideman, playing notes written by someone else. I was known as the band's intellectual. I got along well with the other musicians. I did their income taxes. But my style was different from theirs. Between sets, many of them would disappear into the so-called green room, which would quickly fill with the smell of tobacco and pot. I spent those 20-minute breaks reading books. In the course of a night, I could get in maybe an hour of reading. The books I borrowed from the New York Public Library weren't necessarily what you'd expect to find a young sax player reading. Maybe it was because my father was on Wall Street, or maybe it was my affinity for numbers, but what aroused my curiosity was business and finance. One of the first books I read was about the British stock market. I was fascinated to discover that they used exotic terminology like ordinary shares. I read Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, a book by Edwin Lefevre, about Jesse Livermore, a famous 1920s speculator whose nickname was the Boy Plunger of Wall Street. Legend had it that he made $100 million by short-selling on the eve of the 1929 crash. He got rich and went broke three times before finally committing suicide in 1940. He was a great student of human nature. Lefevre's book is a font of investing wisdom, with Livermore sayings such as, "Bulls and bears make money, but pigs get slaughtered." I also read every book I could find about J.P. Morgan. He not only financed the formation of U.S. Steel, consolidated the railroads, and had a hand in assembling General Electric, but also was the main stabilizing force in the U.S. financial system before the creation of the Federal Reserve. I marveled at his wealth. In breaking up the Morgan Trusts just before World War I, Congress heard testimony that Morgan controlled more than $20 billion. And I was even more impressed by Morgan's character. Famously, J.P. Morgan's word was his bond, and in 1907, it was his personal influence on other bankers that helped stem a financial panic that could have thrown the country into a depression. As a member of the J.P. Morgan board in 1977, I would sit in the same conference rooms at 23 Wall Street where much of the financial chaos of 1907 had been resolved. History overhung 23 Wall. I was sorry when J.P. Morgan sold it in 2003. These stories spoke to me in much the same way railroad timetables had. Wall Street was an exciting place. It wasn't long before I decided